Welcome to Streaming Thoughts, where we stream our thoughts on movies, TV, and all things nerdy. I am Daniel.
And I am Nathan.
And welcome to our podcast. So Nathan, what is on the news docket this week?
Well, follow up on last week's episode, Wonder Woman 84 has broken box office records.
Yeah, I've been seeing that.
Theatrical releases during a pandemic.
I've been seeing that, yeah.
It had an opening theatrical release weekend of $103 million, which normally isn't great, but in the pandemic market, but that dang, has been really good.
That's huge, because, I mean, no other movie has gotten that. Not even Tenet got that.
Right, but I guess what kind of drove this to be so high, and this is domestic, by the way. This is in the United States.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the things that drove this so high is apparently people were so eager and ready to see this in the theater, and I really kind of don't blame them. I wish I had thought about this, that they contacted theater owners and rented out entire theater rooms just for their family, immediate family. Private screenings, like 10,000 theaters across the country offered this. Yeah. And that's what drove up the domestic box office so high.
AMC theaters, I believe they're still doing this, if I'm not mistaken, but you can rent out an entire theater room for $100. I believe that was the fee. It's $99 or something like that. I honestly forgot about that, because that would have been a cool thing to go do.
The close acquaintances that are in your close social bubble, that's like,
yeah,
that might be the safest way to see a movie right now if you really want to see it in the theater.
For sure. I might think about doing something like that for the next big release.
On the wake of a fantastic opening, between what they're saying is on HBO Max download streams, theatrical release, and the international box office, they've already confirmed Wonder Woman 3 is on its way.
Yep, that makes sense. If you're listening to this episode, the Wonder Woman episode has already been up. So if you haven't listened to that one, please go ahead and listen to that one, because we have a lot of thoughts on that movie. And
it was a good movie. I enjoyed it. Go listen to our previous podcast episode if you haven't.
Yeah.
Now, the thing about this announcement with the third movie coming out that has me a little bit disappointed.
Disappointed how?
It was specifically announced that it is a conclusion to Gal Gadot's Wonder Woman.
Interesting.
I mean, I know the Justice League didn't really take off like they were hoping it would take off to be the new Avengers or type movies that everyone looks forward to. And I don't know when they say conclusion of Gal Gadot's Wonder Woman, if that excludes her from future collaborative works with other superheroes. But that kind of had me bummed a little bit.
Especially considering that the Wonder Woman property for DC, as far as this edition of the superheroes that we're seeing on screen, is the most successful one.
Yeah, I mean, if you have anything to build off of, it's Gal Gadot's Wonder Woman. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, think about Man of Steel, think about Batman vs. Superman, Justice League, any of these other films that were released have not performed as well as Wonder Woman has. So yeah, it's a little surprising that they're doing a trilogy and they're sticking to that. It's possible that we're going to see the character of Wonder Woman appear in future Justice League movies, for example.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose it was kind of inevitable that this was going to get a sequel, because it was popular in the theaters, even though I didn't really care for it too much. They are doing a sequel, Boss Baby, Family Business. The thing that gets me is, like, well, one, they're pushing it back from spring to fall 2021, so presumably another COVID-related change, but that also means that they're going to be pushing back their animated film, The Bad Guys, which, I don't know, that genre might be a little bit tapped at the moment for me, but the thing that really gets me, Boss Baby sequel is featuring the two brothers as adults. So
Wait, hold on.
That's what the word is.
Who plays this, the Boss Baby?
Alec Baldwin.
Alec Baldwin, okay. I was like, who would want to come back for a sequel to that? I mean, that was like, who is the actor that was like, yeah, I'll come back. Alec Baldwin. Got it.
Alec Baldwin seems to be willing to come back for anything. I'm kind of interested to see a trailer for this thing, because I'm like, how do you have a movie called Boss Baby and then follow the events of them as all grown up?
Yeah. Look, I haven't seen the first movie and I have zero intentions of ever watching that movie. You know, when you think about that, these are surefire, easy movies to make, because most of it is done by people in rooms. Can be done at home, right? Like all the animators, you know, and then you just have the actors come in.
We did previously talk about a lot of animated movies staying on target because the animators switched to working from home. So
yeah, and the actors just have to go to a sound booth and it's just them in the sound booth and the other people are on the other side of the room. So there's like very low risk, basically, to do that job. So yeah, I mean, it just makes absolutely absolute sense that these movies are being made because of the times they were in. Otherwise, yeah. You know, people might get yelled at by Tom Cruise for not wearing their masks.
I heard the problem was is they were only 5 feet, 3 inches apart, but were using camera tricks to make it look like they're 6 feet apart.
Yeah.
I stole that joke. I don't remember who I stole it from, but I heard that one. I'm like, that was too perfect. And coming soon, we might have a little bit of a debate here. January 15th, are we going to be starting a review on WandaVision that's probably going to be released weekly? Or are we going to do a review on Netflix's Disenchantment from the creators of The Simpsons that's going to release it all at once?
Oh, man. Look, I'm all for WandaVision. I've been so excited for that, and the trailer just made me more excited for it. I cannot wait.
Yeah, I saw they've dropped some more recent trailers, and I have decided I'm at the point that I'm not watching any more trailers or teasers or anything.
Yeah.
Actively avoiding ads, because once I'm sold on a movie, I don't need to see anything more, and mm-hmm. I actively don't want to see anything more, mm-hmm. and that's where WandaVision is for me.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Marvel is really good at subverting your expectations, right? And subverting a lot of what we see on screen. I mean, let's remember the trailers for Avengers Infinity War and Endgame. A lot of what we saw there was not in the movies.
But, I mean, let's say, for instance, I am still going to maybe try and push you to review the Disenfranchisement for me, because it's a Netflix original. We have good track record with those, and it's from the creator of Simpsons, and I'm a huge Simpsons geek, so I might push it for it. But you know what else has been on Netflix original top 10 trending list?
Oh yeah, it's a new one, right? Came out not long ago. It's The Midnight Sky,
starring George Clooney.
Not only starring George Clooney, but directing George Clooney.
Oh, I didn't catch that this was directed by George Clooney. That's yeah, nice.
It is very interesting. I was not expecting that, to be honest. It's not his first film that he's directed, right? He's directed a few other films, but obviously this is going to be most likely his most popular one.
All right. You say this is going to be a popular one. I want to immediately jump into the elephant in the room.
Let's
do it. Online comments regarding this movie have not been kind.
So, okay. Do you want to know what were my thoughts immediately?
Yep.
When the young girl appeared, I started to get a little bit of archive feels.
Yeah, I can see that. Again, archive relating to a previous episode we did.
Yes. If you like Midnight Sky, you're going to like Archive.
Now, I want to say, on my first viewing and just initial watching of this film, I generally enjoyed it. So I was a little bit surprised by the Rotten Tomatoes audience score of 26%. The biggest complaint that I have been seeing from people over that was really driving it down is a lot of people have really not latched on to this slow narrative storytelling pace.
Mm-hmm.
There's no real antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
There's no immediate danger.
Mm-hmm.
This guy's motivation for staying behind to get in contact with this crew that is returning from a 2-year mission to a moon of Jupiter
mm-hmm.
is personal more than a necessity of I must contact them in order to save the human race.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. I completely agree with you on that. We are so used to, I think, seeing or watching really high-paced action, drama-driven TV and films that we sort of don't tend to sit back and appreciate sometimes the slow pacing that sometimes movies can have and how that can help. Like, The Midnight Sky is a perfect example of that. I appreciated this film. I thought this film was pretty good. I didn't have any major issues with it. Well, a couple minor ones with the science of it, you know, but but other than that, I was okay with the movie.
Yeah, it's a disaster movie, but doesn't have that fast action of I'm going to drive a limo through a collapsing building type of action.
Yeah, I mean, if you ever need a limo driver, John Cusack is your guy.
You're right. So the first part of this, I kind of want to focus on just the George Clooney and Iris, the young child Iris. The two protagonists that are in the Arctic research base, moving forward from there. The whole thing with that is it was a environmental survivalist story. We've seen these kind of movies before, mm-hmm. where someone gets stranded in the Yukon and needs to fight against the winter elements who survive. Mm-hmm. But even if you compare it, his story to those, his is a lot more mellow. There's no immediate danger from him as long as he stays inside the research base. When you think that maybe there might be an action scene with like the wolves starting to gather around him, that never really turns into an action sequence. The closest we get to an action sequence is when they are in that survival hub that they find. And it starts to collapse into the water.
Absolutely. I mean, by contrast, let's compare this actually to another movie that is also about survival. That is The Martian. Like, think about the pacing of The Martian and how it is a little bit more action-driven, more drama-driven, right? This one is not. But again, I don't think that Midnight Sky not being on the same pace as The Martian is a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. I appreciated the slow pace of it and it being more intentional about a lot of this stuff that they're actually choosing to show. You're right. This type of survival themes that we tend to see in all of these films tend to be more of the fast pace. We need to survive. You know, danger is imminent. We're going to die. This guy is not, he's drawing this out. He doesn't have 24 hours or something like that. Like, if this was directed, by the way, I just thought of it. This was directed by
J.J. Abrams.
J.J. Abrams, thank you. Then he would only have 24 hours. There is a certain appreciation for being slow and for not sticking to doing the thing that would have been otherwise done in movies like The Martian.
What was your thought on his companion throughout all of this with Iris?
Yeah, first of all, the moment that child showed up, I was like, is she actually real though?
Immediately, I had the same thought, but I thought they did a fairly good job of subverting that idea by starting out the film where they're all the people in the base are evacuating to the underground shelters where they're going to spend who knows how long waiting for the Earth's atmosphere to become habitable again. She's all freaking out that she can't find her kid, and someone's like, oh no, trust me, the kid already went on a previous helicopter. The people loading the helicopters were just like, I don't have a list, man, I'm just putting people on here.
Yeah.
So exactly. When she first showed up, I'm like, see, this is why you have a list.
Yeah. You're right. I think seeing it from that perspective, sure, I could see it. Again, I just got those archive feels. And I couldn't help but start questioning, is this child actually real? But I thought that the addition of this character was actually really good. I think this was executed, to be honest, a little bit better than Archive was executed. Because in Archive, I think that it was more of a self-destructive progression of the guy, right? And his mind sort of declining as he was dying. But this one was more of a personal looking for connection story, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that this is why I think that that whole subversion of the child being this character that helps him move forward. But at the end, we recognized it was never real. It was a whole figment of his imagination because it had a positive end, because he was able to make that connection with his daughter that I think he wanted to make at the end. I think that's what made it a satisfying ending. In Archive, it was not that because it was more of a self-destructive path. I think that's why it just didn't get the same effect, I think.
Now, I only viewed this once. I picked up that as Felicity Jones is telling her story of how and why she always wanted to meet him and how he inspired her to go into space. That his memory of that those same events is what caused him to, in his isolation madness, to manifest this lost child who is there with him, that is his same memory of Felicity Jones when she was a child. But I kind of actually missed if there was a deeper connection as to why he chose her of all people.
Yeah, that is a really good question, right? I don't know if there really was.
Yeah, it was one of the things that, like, okay, she's telling this heartfelt story about why she was connected to him. And if she was going through isolation madness, I can understand why she might have manifested him showing up to talk her through her mission protocols or repairing the space station or anything like that to keep going back to Earth. But I didn't quite pick up why the reverse was the case. Why did he, you know, isolate his memory of his only memory of her, which was when she was that young age? Though it did make sense as to why she never talked, because he only ever had a visual memory of this child. He didn't actually talk to this child or know this child. He just had this visual memory of it. So that's why she never talked to him, because he didn't know what she sounded like. He never talked to her.
Yeah. No, and that's a really interesting detail, right? I totally actually missed it until you pointed out that she didn't talk because he'd never heard her talk. That's actually a really good one. Going back to what you're talking about, why he would experience this, create this figment, right, to drive him to make that connection? Yeah, it's strange. Obviously, I think for him, seeing as he was obviously in a state of decay already, right? I mean, he is dying.
Mm-hmm.
Not only dying a very slow death, but also he is not doing things that are good for him. Like, he's drinking a lot, he's taking drugs. And so I think that combination of I'm gonna die soon, plus I'm drunk, and I have been taking drugs. Here's an imaginary companion that's gonna help me.
Yeah, you know, probably not necessarily the best things to be doing when you're on dialysis
for a life-saving treatment. Yeah, probably not. Pro tip.
Now, using that connection from the ground to the space, let's jump into our space crew.
Oh, yeah.
How long did it take you to make the connection of Felicity Jones to her previous work?
I think for me, it was probably maybe halfway through the film, I started to kind of see, like, oh, wait, we're kind of focusing on her quite a bit more, on the character of Felicity Jones and Iris. And I think that's when I started to pick it up. What about you? When did you pick up?
It was sometime after she started to make first contact and talking to George Clooney, mm-hmm. that I was like, oh, who is this actress? This actor is very familiar to me. Who is this? And I looked it up. I was like, immediately, I'm like, oh yeah, Rogue One. That's it.
Yep, Rogue One.
Overall, I actually really enjoyed some of the comedic beats that she brought to this. Like,
yeah,
she has a dream that she is finishing up her experiments on K-23 and then goes to meet up with them to depart, and they're taken off without her. She wakes up and talks to who we soon find out is her boyfriend, mm-hmm. that she's like, I'm not talking to you. Why? Because in my dream last night, you left me behind on K-23.
That was really great, because that kind of gave you a little bit of the representation of she grew up with her mom, because her mom, like, from the scenes that we got, she was that kind of person too, right? She was this kind of jokester who would say serious things in a jokey way and jokey things in a serious way, right?
Overall, I really enjoyed her take and role in the character, and she kind of outshined all the other crew on this. Aether, was it called? Was the ship,
yeah,
I believe.
The Aether. Yeah, yeah.
She outshined the rest of the crew on the Aether as far as character and personality, in my opinion.
I think that was kind of the intent, right? Because in a way, this
almost
movie...
to have her alone in space while George Clooney is alone on Earth, is your thought?
Right? No, she's with her husband. I think that was intentional. I think this movie was about connecting the two people together across this vast distance and all of this terrible things that are happening on planet Earth and all that. Speaking of terrible things that are happening on planet Earth, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the conditions that led to this, and then what kind of happened, because they didn't really touch much into that. I think it was very brief, it was very subtle, not a whole lot of stuff.
I think the moment they opened it up, and from the very beginning, they're talking about you'll be the last man alive on the surface of the Earth as they're evacuating to the underground shelters. They mm-hmm. refer to it as the event. He makes a comment at one point about not knowing if it was naturally occurring or man-made. Like, did we do this to ourselves or not?
Mm-hmm.
You just want us to know that Earth is dying, and you're not going to tell us what it is.
Right. Exactly. Which in this film, it worked, right? But it sort of left you a little bit wanting as far as, you know, at least taking a little bit more time to explain some of it, right? At least I was looking for that. Even when George Clooney's character, Augustine, made contact with Sully, even then when they were explaining the situation back of what's happening on Earth, it still wasn't like 100% clear. You know, it was more of just like...
Yeah, he was giving them contamination levels and things like that.
Yeah.
So they talk about contamination levels, and then there's a reference of like radiation.
Mm-hmm.
Once the danger was reaching the northern parts of the planet where he was at, he was using air tanks with a face mask.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's radiation,
yeah,
that's not enough to protect you.
Exactly.
Is it a chemical issue or is it biological, viral?
Right.
Oh, the radiation levels are off the charts. Like, okay, well, that's... Yeah, I mean, radiation can be carried in the air by particulates that... Yeah. Are bad if you breathe them in because they can cause lung cancer and other bad things like that. But if it is high enough that the birds were flying out of the sky dying, sorry, you have more worries than just breathing it at that point.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Definitely. That is when I felt that the issues with the science or some of the aspects of the science of this movie kind of started to feel like, oh, come on, you could have done a little bit better on that. That, for example, was one, like, wait, birds are flying, falling out of the sky dead, but like, you're totally cool with just the face mask? That wouldn't be okay with that if it was radiation. And then actually the first issue I had with this movie was when they were talking about K-23, a previously undiscovered moon in Jupiter. And I'm like, that, no.
Actually, we do find new moons of Jupiter regularly. They're just usually pretty small.
But that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. If it was a significantly large moon, we would have found it by now.
On that, the idea that a moon, a large enough moon around Jupiter, it's outside of the sun's Goldilocks zone, but it could theoretically be close enough to Jupiter that tidal forces keeps the molten core active enough to keep it warm on the surface. That part's theoretically possible.
That one, yes. I will give them that.
But they would be having, like, very severe seismic activity on the planet, which would make it not necessarily the most pleasant to live on. Then the whole thing about them coming back, and they're talking about this is an unmapped course. I really have to wonder, was the original book them going to a different solar system and coming back? While they were like, okay, well, we want this in the near future, and we can't make it to a solar system and back in one lifespan, so let's bring in a little closer, just create a new moon around Jupiter.
Yeah, and also, let's remember, this is 2049. I figure that by 2049, we'd be pretty good at traveling around the solar system. The whole mapping of, like, this is an uncharted sector. What are you talking about, uncharted? We are still in our solar system. Well, how could we not see what's out there? That's ridiculous. We can already see so much.
Clouds of small particles like that, we have those fairly well mapped out at the moment. And yeah, maybe there could be a possibility that we miss some the farther from Earth that they are, but they were already pretty close to Earth at that point.
Yeah, they were.
On their return trajectory, because they very quickly reestablished a instantaneous communication with Earth. So that means they weren't that far from Earth when they were encountering these unknown regions. So it's like...
Right. And that's the part that I think bugged me about that. I know that to most people, they wouldn't really care about that stuff, but hey, we're nerds, so we're going to pay attention to that.
Because the moment he was trying to get communication and was talking about instantaneous communication, I'm like, well, they have to be pretty close to Earth, because I knew how long it took for us to send a signal to a probe at Jupiter and receive a signal back, because we previously had probes out that far and crashed a probe into Jupiter. So for our trivia for our listeners at home, what is the light distance from Earth to Jupiter on average? If you know the answer, you can always tweet us at
Streaming Geek.
So I was like, they have to be really close. My thought on that was, they evacuated not that long ago. They've been having enough time to prepare underground shelters for massive large groups of people and have evacuation plans crafted, organized, and put into place.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we wouldn't have instantaneous communication, they still would have been there and sending a message back saying, hey, we landed successfully, and NASA being like, hey, good job. And then that back and forth, then all of a sudden NASA might be saying, like, hey, you know what? Things are kind of going a little dicey down here. How do you feel about staying a little bit longer?
Or, you know, automate that process somehow, right? I mean, they had artificial intelligence, it seemed like, on the ship, right? Or at least some kind of intelligence.
Yeah.
This taking place in the future, it's one of those things that just seem like you could have automated this.
They had AI to the point that it would be like me and you working together, and I'm asking, like, hey, Dan, can you complete this task for me? And you say, oh, yes, I will complete this task. Now, we have some things like Siri on the iPhone and the Amazon version of it, which I'm blanking on what Amazon calls theirs. Alexa, that's it.
Yeah.
So we start, it's basically saying, oh yeah, those kind of voice assistants have extended to the point that it works on basic human conversation level and it can respond. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's like, if they're that far ahead, there should have been a beacon at least, like, even if they lost communication for some reason, there should have been a beacon that as they came, were coming back, they started getting updates. This is what the planet is like. You may not want to come back. You may want to look at changing your trajectory in some way to loop back to the moon that you determined was habitable, whatever the case may be.
Mm-hmm. That's, I think, is sometimes the trouble that I have with films that take place in the future.
Anytime they want to get the science right and then they don't in some way, it stands out a lot more than when they just don't try to get the science right at all.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that got me was the spaceship itself.
Ooh, yeah, I wanted to ask about that too.
When they first introduced the spaceship, they show these, they show it from an exterior shot, I believe first, where you see it has rotating sections.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first time you see it is just on a monitor on George Clooney's screen.
Yeah.
Down at the base.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see the interior shots, and it's these wide, spacious rooms as they move through the rotating sections that have the simulated gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And then she is floating in near zero microgravity through the center part of it. I was like, okay, they're trying to get this accurate.
Mm-hmm.
She sits down at a workstation. They switch to an exterior shot going out away from her, so you can see how big she is through the window compared to the rest of the ship. And immediately I'm like, that inside does not fit in that outside unless if they have figured out TARDIS technology.
Yeah, I actually had similar thoughts.
And then on top of that, they then show that the ship is cruising through space with its acceleration engines on.
On, yeah.
With those acceleration engines on, that means they would not be that microgravity interior that you're seeing. Mm-hmm. Because constant acceleration, they'd be feeling that acceleration inside the ship.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, in those rotating section, anytime they're moving, it would be like they're walking uphill one direction, walking downhill another direction.
Yeah.
It's like, no, this is space, y'all. Once you get up to speed,
there are rules here.
The whole purpose of having that rotating section is to save fuel. You get up to speed, you shut your engine off. And then when they went through the micrometeor cloud and their engines got shut off and like the ship listed or something like that, it's like,
well, no, like they lost radar and they lost, you know, comms and
the visual of it. When they when the engines got shut off, you could see the ship actually turn. And it's just like, no, objects in motion stay in motion. That's how it works,
unless otherwise affected. To most people, they wouldn't really care, but again, us being nerds and paying attention to that kind of stuff, we notice it. We absolutely notice that. Although I do like the fact that the ship looked like it was, and I think that they reference in the film, if I recall correctly, 3D printed.
Yeah.
Which would make perfect sense.
If you look at people who do large 3D printing structures and they have to create this kind of matrix to support it while it's in the process of being printed, there's a lot of the interior shots have that kind of support structure.
Mm-hmm.
Shapes and dimensions. That's what gave it away for me. I thought kind of makes sense. I mean, a ship that large, feasibly to launch it, it's not going to launch from Earth. It has to
be somehow
constructed either on the moon or in orbit.
Yep.
The idea of having some means of bringing up raw materials to be supplied to a 3D printer to print off section by section in space as they proceed to assemble it, that actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, just the interior of it, just looking at the support structures that you were talking about, that looks like it was definitely like a 3D printed design. And I really liked the overall design of the ship and the overall design of the interior of the ship, except for how big the inside is compared to the outside in some situations. I really, really enjoyed what they did with the set design on the ship.
Now, on that, when they did their spacewalk, they were trying to, again, stick to the science of you can't really hear anything in space because there's no medium for it to travel, except when their helmet struck the edge or their glove struck it, you could pick up the vibration of that contact through the atmosphere that's within their spacesuits. But then, your favorite topic, they also had the music playing for it. Did you think that music in that situation enhanced the scene or kind of detracted from the fact that they were trying to be legit accurate with sound in space or the lack thereof?
I thought that in that situation, the music actually didn't really do a good job of doing that. I remember Gravity, for example, did it best, if you recall that movie, right? There was no music in when the impacts were happening. Again, I mean, it's another one that there's a lot of issues with that movie too, with regards to science, but that sequence,
it featured George Clooney, and George Clooney should not have died in that movie, because just give him a little tug and now he's floating back to you. Don't cut him free.
Exactly. So with that movie, you know, it was silent, right?
They did a lot of silent aspects to that, yeah.
Yeah, and so I think that that really created that sense of fear and that sense of dread because of that, and just really created that impact and then put you in that space where you could actually feel more immersed. And then I think that the immersion was taken because of the music in this case. So I don't think that there should have been any music in that section.
Yeah, that was pretty much my takeaway on it too. It's just, you just always like looking at the music and the composition of any film we watch. So I wanted to get your feel on that.
Yeah.
Because that was definitely my takeaway. I was like, it distracted you because it masked the fact that they were trying to be more scientifically accurate with the lack of sound in space.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to see someone on YouTube edit just that sequence and then remove the music and then just play the original and play the one without the music and see if there's a difference in terms of tonality, what it does to that scene if you remove music, right? So hey, if somebody can do that, that'd be super cool. You can let us know.
Yeah, send it to us on Facebook at Streaming Thoughts.
Yeah.
Get a few more plugs on this time around.
Yeah, so Nathan, should we jump into our TLDL?
Too long, didn't listen.
All right, and this is a section where we'll give you our closing thoughts on the movie or TV show that we're watching. So Nathan, The Midnight Sky, TLDL.
On casual first viewing, this movie to me was a slow pace without any strong, significant action sequences, with one notable exception while featuring the crew in space. It was generally a slow-paced, character-driven movie, and as long as that's what you're looking for, that can be enjoyable. But the moment you start digging deeper into what this movie is all about and what is happening, it just starts falling apart, and it just really falls apart and becomes a lot less of a quality in overall plot and story-driven aspects of it. So watch it for character-driven story. Don't think too much about it. That's my best advice for you.
Totally, completely agree with you on that. I think that if I had to pick between The Midnight Sky and Archive as my favorite of that same category, definitely Midnight Sky wins. Archive, I think that had a lot of really cool and clever executions on some of the stuff, but ultimately, because it was a very negative ending, I felt like it didn't really do a good job at bringing the audience to a sort of, you know, you want to land the airplane, right? We'll reach the peak and I won't want to come down. And I felt like this movie did a really good job with that versus Archive. And so if you love character-driven stories, this is it. If, you know, if you start paying attention to some of the science and some of this other stuff and the plot, and you know, then it starts to fall apart, like you said, a little bit. Not too bad, though. Not to the point where it becomes unwatchable. We're being nitpicky, which is typically sometimes what we do. Here in this podcast.
With that, Dan, one final nitpicky comment/question. Why on earth did they let those two people leave the ship? Because if the underground structures and underground escape bunkers fail and these people turn out to be the last of humanity, just mom, dad, and pregnant daughter in the belly is not a viable colony population. What are they thinking?
Not to mention the fact that there will be a point when he will have to run the entire ship by himself.
Yeah.
So, how's he gonna do that? But hey, if you thought it's a good idea, or if you think it's a good plan for these two to set out into the unknown and rebuild Earth, if you thought that was a good plan, then definitely let us know on Facebook at
Streaming Thoughts and on Twitter at
Streaming Geek.
This has been Nathan.
And this has been Daniel.
Thank you for listening.